Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Segregation in American schools, not just a historical phenomenon. We'll spend the hour today with author and school teacher Jonathan Kozol about the shame of the nation, the restoration of apartheid schooling in America. But I can't help myself, why should I? This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Despite the gains made after the 1954 desegregation ruling Brown versus Board of Education, schools today are more segregated than ever. My guest, Jonathan Kozol, well known for his books about the American educational system and children's rights, has a new book out. It's called The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. His previous book, for which he's well known, is Savage Inequalities. For this book, Jonathan Kozol visited 60 schools in 11 states over a five-year period and found that schools in the U.S. are racially segregated and that wealthy white suburbanites receive far better facilities and resources for their children than poor children of color. Kozol believes that a new civil rights movement will be necessary to eradicate the injustices of the educational system. I spoke with Jonathan Kozol in studio recently. What were the gains made in school reintegration after that decision, and what effect did desegregation have on the performance of children in schools?
Well, the gains from Brown versus Board of Education, as I describe it in my new book, In the Shame of the Nation, the gains were self-evident and dramatic. Brown versus Board of Ed was not enforced immediately. It was handed down by the Supreme Court in 1954, but it wasn't for about 10 years that it was seriously enforced. But starting from the late 1960s right up until the late 1980s, the Brown decision had sweeping effects. It created integrated education in tens of thousands of schools throughout the United States, not only in the South, but particularly in the South. And during that period of time, very important to note, the achievement gap between black and Latino kids on the one hand and white kids on the other narrowed dramatically. In other words, minority children were catching up to white children because they were going to the same well-funded schools that white children attended. Starting around 1990, the U.S. Supreme Court, under Rehnquist and Scalia and Clarence Thomas and so forth, under that majority, a conservative majority, started ripping apart Brown versus Board of Education, virtually dismantling all its enforcement instruments. So that since that time, public schools in America have reverted to virtually apartheid education in all the major cities. I go into schools today in almost any major city from New York to Los Angeles in an inner city neighborhood. I simply never see any white children at all. And I might add that during this period in which we've seen this this sweep back to segregation again, we've also seen a dramatic widening of the gap in achievement between minority kids and white kids. So that today, for example, at this moment, the average black or Latino 12th grader in America reads and writes at the level of the average white 7th grader. Amazing. And that's just talking about the minority kids who even get to 12th grade. That's forgetting all the hundreds of thousands who drop out. Now, when I visit these schools today, I visited 60 schools across the country, including four in California. I simply never see white kids in these schools. There could be 5,000 kids in the school, as in some of these huge high schools in Los Angeles. And, you know, there'll be 5,000 black and Latino kids and maybe occasionally in two white children and three who are called other. And nobody ever says who other is. Well, he sounds like somebody who's striped. If you took a photo of these classrooms that I visit, the photo would look exactly like the photographs of Mississippi 50 years ago, a classroom in Mississippi 50 years ago. In New York City, in the Bronx, in the South Bronx, which is where I've been working with children for about 15 years, written several books about the South Bronx, in that neighborhood, 99.8% of the children in the schools are black or Latino. So, you know, some people say, well, you shouldn't use words like apartheid, which I do in the...
In the title.
Yeah. And in the subtitle of my book, The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. And some people don't like that. The uptight people who insist that everything be vague and nuanced say, well, apartheid, that's rather strong. That only applies to legal segregation. And what I say is, okay, if you want to be precise about it, here we have these 99.8% minority schools in New York, in L.A., in Chicago. If you want to be precise, 0.2 percentage point mark the difference between legally enforced apartheid in the South of 50 years ago and socially and economically arranged apartheid in these cities now. And these schools are savagely unequal. I mean, anybody who comes into these schools can see it right away. Little kids I write about in New York City right now get about $11,000 a year put into their education. You lift up these black and brown children, these little babies, because I write about little kids, like third graders. You lift them up in your arms and you plunk them down in a wealthy white suburb of New York. Instead of $11,000, they'd be getting $22,000 a year put into their public education. And you'd see the same differences or comparable differences in Chicago and St. Louis and Philadelphia and Detroit and Los Angeles with a vengeance. This is one of the most unequal states in the country. Also, California is one of the four most segregated states for black and Latino children. So, you know, here we are after all these years. I grew up in the 60s. I started my career not just as a teacher, but also as a civil rights activist. I sat at the feet of Dr. King. I heard him preach many times. And I remember these young people my age who left Boston and New York. I grew up in Boston and went down to Mississippi to save the soul of the South in the civil rights movement, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, and other martyrs of that era. And now I come into these schools like Fremont High School in Los Angeles, which is a nightmare. It's like a tribute to apocalyptic apartheid in L.A., and I look around the school, and I look at the faces of the kids, and I try to tell myself that it's for this postmodern millennial apartheid that Martin Luther King and all our other martyrs gave their lives. Mm. And it's just, to me, it's the worst betrayal of principle that I've seen in my adult life.
In your book, you talk about dishonoring the dead, where there are so many schools named after the civil rights leaders who are fighting for integration that are the worst examples of such.
Yeah, there's a joke among a lot of older veteran black educators. They'll say to me, because these are folks I've known for years, and we talk, they talk to me very trustingly, because we've been in the trenches all these years, and sometimes older black principals or teachers will say to me, Jonathan, if you come to a new city and you want to visit a really segregated school, just ask for a school that's named for Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks or Thurgood Marshall or Cesar Chavez or Dolores Huerta, you know, any of the sort of heroes of the integration and human justice struggles of an earlier decade. And that's true. I go into New York, they wanted to honor Jackie Robinson, you know, who's known for only one thing, because he broke the color line in baseball. He was, you know, Mr. Integration for baseball. So what do they do in order to honor Jackie Robinson in New York? They give him a school. They name a school for him that's 97% black and Hispanic. I think it's like 1% white and 2% other. And that's classic everywhere. I always wonder why we name these horrible schools for people that black folks love. Right. I always think we ought to name them for people they don't like.
Reagan.
Yeah, well, you know, Clarence Thomas right. Academy of Self-Help and Self-Hate, or Bill Bennett Academy of High Personal Morality, you know,
right.
George Bush Academy of Garbled Syntax. But save the name of Dr. King for a school that justifies right. his dream.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Kozol, and he's written The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. You talked about how people get upset when they hear you use the word apartheid.
Yeah.
And today we see this, you know, a lot of these buzzwords like tolerance, like diversity, especially used to disguise or hide some of the really horrific injustices. Can you talk a little bit about how that's used in schools?
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's like the media, the mainstream white-owned press, is embarrassed to say that the schools in its own city are segregated. So, for example, in New York, the New York Times will speak of schools in other cities as being segregated. Mm-hmm. In Chicago, you know, they say segregated schools. But when it comes to New York, the word never comes up because they're embarrassed. New York, if you're interested, is the most segregated and unequal state for minority black and Hispanic kids in the country. So in New York, in order to defend the civic image and sort of sweeten the pill of apartheid, what the press does is they'll go to a school where, like, you know, like 4,000 black and Latino kids go to class with maybe 6 white kids in this building, and they'll say, and maybe 3 Southeast Asian kids, something like that, and they'll say, this is a school with a diverse serving a diverse population, and sometimes it will say a school with many minorities. And this many minorities is purposely ambiguous, as though they were Albanians or Ukrainians or something. No, this diverse has come to be the newspaper's semantic somersault. What diverse means today is not diverse. What diverse means today is segregated. And what really makes me sick is to go to colleges which are virtually all white, in which they think they're being progressive by having all the kids take a course in diversity. Virtually all white college, they do nothing to assure diversity of population among their students or among their faculty, but then they make everyone feel good by taking a course where they read these sweet stories about brave black children 50 years ago in the South who braved federal marshals, you know, challenged the federal marshals or the local cops, rather, to go to cross the color line. And these stories make everybody feel ever so happy. And they should. You cannot teach diversity genuinely in a school that is not diverse. And if they want to do something genuine in segregated white schools, instead of teaching these sappy courses on diversity where everybody feels good, and that they ought to teach a course in political action to create diversity on their campus.
Right. Now, the fact that you don't see, that you see so many colleges that are predominantly white, the student body is predominantly white, certainly has a lot to do, of course, with not just the poor quality of education, but in your book you talk great detail about the indoctrination in schools where poor black and brown kids go that are sort of, they're prepared for these management jobs and children are commodified.
Yeah, and they're not really management jobs. They're bottom level management jobs. They're like cashier's jobs. Let me describe this quickly. What we're seeing now is not only apartheid schools, but an apartheid curriculum. We've seen an entirely new curriculum evolve, targeted at children of color in the lowest performing inner city schools, which are overwhelmingly minority, of course. And what it amounts to is the following. First of all, virtually no critical thinking, because it's all geared to trying to pump the test scores. The principals in these schools, many of them are very decent people, whom I've known for years. A lot of them are older African-American women in the elementary school level whom I've known, who are sort of valiant, heroic people, but they are so terrorized, number one, by the federal law, No Child Left Behind, and number two, by similar laws that come from state boards of education in Sacramento or Albany or whatever state we're in, that they live or die by numbers, by tests. And even like a little tiny jump of 2 percentage points can make them look good, or a drop of 2 percentage points can make them look bad. So they, in turn, pass on this terror to the teachers. And the teachers are given scripted curriculums. I know, because I studied Latin. I had to study Latin as a kid. I should say curricula, but I'll say curriculums, not to sound like a pretentious Harvard dweeb that I am. But they give them these scripted lesson plans. Now, in some states, the very worst ones I've ever seen are called SFA. It's called Success for All. It's a brand name product. It's just terrible. Probably the second worst scripted literacy system in the country is called Open Court, and that's the one, unfortunately, which Roy Roma has ordained for all the low-performing schools of Los Angeles. A terrible choice. I mean, it's just it's vulgar, shabby, mediocre literacy instruction, like a sort of clumsy phonics approach. And I'm not opposed to phonics, by the way. I've taught phonics. I'm not one of those, those flaky types who think that, you should just children will magically learn to read on their own. And, they used to be counterculture types and open classroom types who would just say, oh, it's don't worry that Peter can't read. He may be 10 years old, but when he's ready to read, he'll let us know. And, that I can't use the proper word to describe what that was. But, that was nonsense. And that drove the nation quite far to the right, because a lot of people swung the opposite direction. But what we see today is we see the extreme opposite in these schools, where every minute has to be targeted on the examination, and the teacher has to write on the blackboard the name and number of the state standard she's teaching at every minute of the day. She has to hold a timer in her hand. I'm saying she, because in elementary school it's usually a woman. She has to hold a timer in her hand so that I stayed up half of last night talking to two LA teachers. If people from the state come around, or from the district, from the teachers call the curriculum cops to make sure they're on the right sentence at the right moment, that's if they're not, they get in trouble. They get written up in a report by the principal, so they hold these timers in their hands. And so, let's say a child comes in and actually surprises the teacher and the class by saying, my mother or my grandma read me this poem by Langston Hughes or Sandra Cisneros or something. And, you know, some grown-up poetry is accessible to children. And I loved it. And he starts talking about it. No, the teacher has to cut him off because that's not in the script. See, so the motivation that comes from the child is suppressed. And instead, the only kind of motivation that they use in these classrooms is a kind of Skinnerian motivation. Do you know, I'm referring to B.F. Skinner, the rat control scientist. It's really sort of rat control psychology applied to children. The only motivation that's relevant is the one that you can stimulate by a scripted question to which the child has to give a predicted answer. It tells you in the script the answer the child must give. And, you know, so meanwhile, out in the suburbs, kids are reading real literature. They're not just reading these horrible. Open Court is an atrocity. Anyone who's listening to us ought to, they ought to barricade the Board of Education here and ask Superintendent Romer why he picked something so mediocre, which I doubt that any educated person in this city would ever give their own child to read. Out in the suburbs, meanwhile, they're reading beautiful books, real books. They're learning phonics and they're learning to think and comprehend from lovely literature books like my favorite book right now of all books is called The Very Hungry Caterpillar. Have you ever seen that book?
No.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's very, very, very hungry caterpillar, I usually say. And these are beautiful classic, you know, sort of new classics for children. Or Maurice Sendak's wonderful book, Where the Wild Things Are. And they get, so the suburban kids are getting all these treasures. They're also learning how to ask probing and discerning questions. They're learning to interrogate reality. And they're learning, in a sense, the skills that will be required to be politically sagacious grown-ups someday in order to shape the future of our nation. While the kids in these inner-city schools being drilled to death by these awful scripted lesson plans and being tested to death they're not learning to ask questions. They're learning to give the answers. And this is the way you create two classes in society, one of which will govern and one of which will be forever subordinate to the other. And at its worst, you see this in the high schools. In Los Angeles, I walked into one high school, Fremont High, which is in South Central LA, although I notice the city is now engaging in the Orwellian game of renaming neighborhoods so people won't think they're slums anymore. So what is it now called? South LA? Yeah. And people are thinking of renaming the South Bronx. You know, I don't know what they'll call it, something like beautiful, beautiful slum or something. But it's South Central. I go into Fremont High. It looks like a prison. It's surrounded by spoked metal walls. There are about 5,000 kids in this building. There's so many kids that about half of them have to have their class in trailers. In California, for some reason I do not know, they don't call them trailers. They call them bungalows. I can't believe it.
That's Orwellian. Yeah,
bungalows are cute. Bungalows are cute little houses where Jack and Jill play, right? Or Hansel and Gretel. Bungalows are little sweet places. Now, these aren't sweet places. These are smelly trailers, but they call them bungalows. It's part of the deception industry. And anyway, I walked into a class at Fremont High with 40 kids in it. This was a 10th grade history, a political science class. The teacher is a wonderful teacher, Sarah Canope, handed me her... Well, I said to her, how do you teach 40 kids? And she said, I have six classes like this every day. I said, how do you do it? And she says, essentially, she teachers always do this to me. She says, here, find out. You can have them. And she gave me her class for an hour. And fortunately, she stayed with me in the room. But the kids were wonderful. They really vented they knew I was a writer and they vented their feelings. And the whole book is sort of made up of things like this where the kids talked to me. And some of them were so moving, they stayed for a second hour and others came in. So basically I taught this class for the last 2 hours of the day, right through. And one wonderful girl in that class who was obviously college bound in her, in her ambitions. She was very bright. There's no question she could have gone to college. If she grew up in a suburb that I grew up in outside of Boston, she, you know, probably could have gone to Harvard or Ivy League colleges if she wanted. She was so smart. She says, last year they made me take a sewing class. She was real upset about this. And now this year, she said, she was being like channeled into a hairdressing class. And I expressed sort of my, you know, shock at this. And I want to make clear, I don't have any disrespect for anybody who does any kind of career, but still, you know, she wanted to go to college, so what are they doing to her? And then another little girl in the class, to me, they seemed like little kids because, you know, I'm 69. A little, very small, spunky African-American girl whom I instantly came to like, saw how incredulous I was. And she said, I took hairdressing twice. I said, no, you didn't get credit for it twice, did you? Academic credit? She said, yes. One was hairdressing and one was advanced hairdressing. So it's like we're teaching AP hairdressing to women of color. So at that point, the first student, Mariah, started to cry in front of the whole class. And she said, I didn't need to learn to sew. My mother sews. My mother works in a garment factory. I don't think you need to learn to sew to go to college. And she kept repeating, I already knew how to sew. I'd hoped for something more. And a guy in the class who was just terrific, a wonderful, wonderful young man named Fortino, who had long hair, he looked like Che Guevara, interesting guy. And if you met him in the street, he might have frightened you because he looked a little tough. His eyes just had this simmering, the cynical intelligence is the way I would describe it. His dark eyes just full of this cynical intelligence. And he looks right at Mariah when she starts to cry, because she's crying now. And he says, listen, Mariah, the owners of the factories need laborers, right? And, you know, he's tough. And she says, I guess so. And he says, they're not going to hire their own kids for those jobs, are they? And another student says, why not? And Mariah says, so they can grow beyond themselves, but we remain the same. When I left, this girl Mariah was one of, she stayed with me all day. I later met with the teachers and she wouldn't leave. And at the end of the afternoon, around 5, when I finally left the school, she came up to me and she said, why is it that we who need so much get so little and those who need it less get so much more? And I said to her, well, you know, I've been working for 40 years and I still don't have an answer. That broke my heart. That was the most moving experience in my entire 5 years of research. And people who have read the book always stop on that page and they say, what the hell are we doing to these kids? Would any school superintendent like Roy Romer do that to his own daughter? And if he wouldn't do it to his own daughter or granddaughter, if white people listening to us wouldn't do it to their daughters, then we should not be doing that to the child of the poorest black or Latino woman in this city either. This is unacceptable. It ought to stop. And teachers themselves and other people listening to us, you know, ought to not just write letters to the newspaper about it, because that's useless, really. What they ought to do is organize militant protests, not just against the big issues that I write about, not just against the overwhelming racial segregation of LA schools, not just against the gross financial inequalities, not just against the testing nightmare, but against the entire structure of what really amounts to a kind of passive intellectual genocide of these children. I call it cognitive decapitation.
Jonathan Kozol is author of The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. When we come back from our break, we'll continue our interview. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm speaking with Jonathan Kozol, author of The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Kozol. He is author of The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America. There's a lot to talk about. You mentioned the issue of standardized testing, of course, is a really, really big deal. As a teacher, can you describe for our listeners what effect, what impact that has on little children? You describe what happens to teachers and how they have to deal with it. But these days, they're abolishing recess and changing summer vacation.
Well, here's what's happened. Not everywhere, but in too many places. What happens is, first of all, when everything in the school is geared to the test, and in these really overwhelmingly minority urban schools, everything is geared to the test. When this happens, the child learns that nothing you read, no knowledge you acquire, is of value for its own sake. It's valuable only if it can be translated into a number that provides some kind of external reward. In other words, the reward is no longer in the soft perplexities of Pooh. Remember Winnie the Pooh?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite characters. You remember there's all sort of this... These lovely epiphanies where he wanders. He keeps going around the tree and he thinks he's following a big animal, a heffalump, and it's really his own little paws he's following around the tree. So you can't just... The reward isn't that I enjoyed that. I loved that. And I saw how beauty is created in a book. The reward isn't the sort of the charm of the sorrowful pronouncements of Eeyore. Remember Eeyore? For those who haven't read it, he's the donkey without a tail. Is that right? I don't think
yes.
he has a tail.
I think so.
I think Eeyore is like one of the great tragic figures of literature, right up there with King Lear. I love him. Anyway, see, so these kids, I mean, they don't even get to read these books in these books like that in these schools. Nor do they read good multicultural stuff. I mean, they don't read books. They read a vulgarized a version of books in these scripted textbooks. So what happens is, first of all, the tests tell them that nothing that forget the expression by which all civilized, well-educated people have always lived, that art is to be valued for its own sake. Throw that out the window. No, beauty is not to be valued for its own sake. The heartbreak that you might read about in a novel for older children, the Bluest Eye, for example, a Toni Morrison book, a grown-up book, that's not to be valued for its own sake. The only thing that counts is whether you can extract from anything you read three state proficiencies that are listed in the standards for the state and will then be measured on an exam. Second effect it has on these little kids is that it creates for the vast numbers who are not doing well because of their overcrowded, squalid, smelly schools, and their so-called bungalows, these smelly trailers where they go to school. It's just amazing. The state of California, one of the richest places in the world. If it were a country, it would be one of the richest countries in the world.
Fifth largest economy.
Yeah, that you're running a third world school system here for poor people. It's just outrageous. But anyway, if you just like added like a 10% surtax to every home in California that has a gate that locks, a property surtax or wealth surtax or something, you could at least bring your schools up to the mediocre level of Connecticut or Ohio. But now you're right down there with Louisiana and Mississippi. In any case, these kids live in terror of the test, so they're in a state of anxiety, and the President Bush has not proposed money to help them be well educated so they can pass the test. In fact, he's cut preschool. The Head Start budget is now serving less of the eligible children, less poor children in America than any time since Mr. Bush came to office. So they're not even getting good pre-K preparation, which the rich are getting through private programs. And then they come into school, and in some cities in California, in some districts, they start high-stakes standardized exams in first grade or kindergarten even. Now, most schools in America start in third grade, which is still too early, I think. But to start it in kindergarten is like sadistic. There are several, not only in California, but other states, they started in kindergarten on the basis that they have to get the kids ready to know how to take the test when they count 2 years later. You understand? So these aren't just nice, old-fashioned tests where the teacher sits with the child and sort of reviews the child's work. Those are called diagnostic tests where you then can help the child. No, these are standardized exams where the tests are sent off to some company thousands of miles away, McGraw-Hill, which is one of the largest testing corporations, very close to the Bush family, by the way, the owners of McGraw-Hill. Then the results come back the following summer. So they're no use to these high stakes tests are of no use to the teacher in the year in which they're given, or they come back 6 months later.
So they're supposed to be used to figure out where the weaknesses of the children are.
Yeah, President Bush, I don't know what planet he lives on. He keeps saying the all we want to do with these standardized tests is help dear Miss O'Brien figure out how she can help little Shaniqua or Susan in second grade with where does this little girl need extra help. But Mr. Bush doesn't seem to understand that in most schools these test results don't come back until June or July of the following year. So that's the end of the school year. Sometimes they don't come back till September. Anyway, in California and in other states where they're doing it in kindergarten, you get these little kids who don't even know that pages go from left to right. I mean, in one district in California, in Santa Clara, they started doing this in September of kindergarten year. September, that's when kids first enter school. And these little children, they're overwhelmingly Latino kids, poor kids. Very few of them had pre-K. You know, everybody in Beverly Hills buys their children expensive pre-K programs starting from the age of two or something. So they rig the game they rig the game almost from the cradle. These kids have had none of that, but so they don't know how to hold a pencil since they can't hold a crayon. There's no way they're going to figure out how to fill in those bubbles. But these tests have the same kind of answer sheets that the SATs have. Do you understand? And so the little kids pee in their pants, and the teacher isn't allowed to help them. The only thing she can say is, "All by yourself, keep on, all by yourself, do your best," something like that. Now, who would possibly conceive of a nightmare like this? Mr. Bush is under the delusion that if you test kids and terrorize them with the fear of failure on a test, this is a good substitute for equal opportunity, for equal schooling. But it ain't, and it's not working, and the race gap, the achievement gap, is widening. And worse than that, of course, another kind of gap is widening, which is the gap is what I call a cultural gap in the sense of being able to think critically about your society. So we're not simply shortchanging these inner city kids in terms of hard skills like arithmetic and reading comprehension. We're also crippling their intellectual capacities. We're suppressing the intellectual bravado which enables people to ask tough questions about the society they live in. We're creating people who will be no problem to society in the future.
Right.
Creating people who will go to the sewing factory and sew, And meanwhile, the kids out in the suburbs will be gaining the skills with which to run the sewing factory or own it someday.
In fact, none of this, of course, could happen were it not for the suburban parents and their wealthier white parents who will obviously do what they can to give their children a leg up, you know, for them to just basically go along with it. I want to end by asking you, how do white, largely white suburban wealthy parents, what do they do to separate their children from black and brown poor children with respect to getting their kids into competitive schools and in some cases even subsidizing the public school system?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's not simply the inequalities in between wealthy white suburban schools and inner city minority schools aren't just because of state funding practices, though those are bad enough, but also because parents in the wealthy districts are now raising money privately. Even within the city, even within LAUSD or within the New York City schools, parents in a particularly exclusive upscale neighborhood are holding like auctions and fundraising parties where in some cases they've raised up to $1 million to hire more teachers, to physically rebuild their school to make it an attractive place for children.
And this is legal?
Yeah, unfortunately, it shouldn't be. It should be illegal, but it's tolerated because it's tolerated because these people are politically powerful, and so essentially, we're ending up with something that I call hybrid schools. They're public in the sense they get public money, but they're private in the sense that they get all this extra private money to reduce class size and have terrific libraries and stuff. The other thing, of course, that white privileged people do, and I don't blame them for, you know, look, I don't blame anyone for doing the best, so assume it's a mother, doing the best she can for her own child. That's human nature. The thing is that if they, by narrowing their sense of civic decency to the limit of their school or their district, they create a situation where they only fight for their own child instead of fighting for everybody's child. If these folks would spend less time going to these fancy little lunches, and I meet a lot of women, I hope this is unfair, but I guess these are wealthy wives of wealthy men who spend an awful lot of time having lunches planning fundraising parties, and then they go to the fundraising party, and you know, if they spend less time, if they put all that energy instead into allying themselves with poor people, with the leaders of the poor, parents of the poor, in order to storm the barricades of Sacramento to demand very high funding for all the public schools, for all the kids in this state, or if they went to Washington and joined with those of us who think it's a federal obligation, then they wouldn't be put into this morally untenable position, because most of the people I know in the white suburbs do not hate Latino and black children. If they meet the little kids I write about, if I were to introduce them to Mariah, that lovely student at Fremont High, most people I know, I still have some rich friends in California. They're a little nervous with me, but they still invite me to dinner. They think I want to redistribute their wealth, which I do, but they're still friends of mine. And if they met Mariah, they'd do anything they could for her. They would say, hey, she's a wonderful student. Let me write to my friend at some college and see if I can help her get a scholarship, get in. This is the great tragedy, because residential segregation is so absolute in this state, they'll never meet Mariah. That's the trouble. They won't ever know her. What apartheid does, what segregation does for the rich, for the most potentially compassionate rich people, potentially decent privileged people, is to protect them from their own conscience. so they can go on doing everything for their kid and shutting the Mariahs of the world out of their hearts. And you know, government institutions can do two things. They can elicit the best in a population, or they can bring out the meanest qualities of a population because of the shameful residential segregation of L.A., New York, Chicago, and so forth, and because of the cynical policies of Mr. Bush in Washington and the possibly more cynical policies of the governor in California, whose name I hate to say, it's because of these policies, good people in this community never have a chance to act upon their potential decency. So, you know, we need a big struggle, and the struggle has to come from at least two directions. First, it has to come from those who are suffering most, and then it has to come from those among the privileged who say that they who tell us that they still honor the values of Martin Luther King, who tell us that they still honor Brown versus Board of Education, while in practice they rip apart Dr. King's dream and rip apart the legacy of Brown. There's got to be an uprising of conscience. And that's what, you know, everywhere I go at the end of my talk, people say, well, could you give us like a 7-point plan to improve our ghetto schools? And I say, no, I'm too old to do that. I used to do that. I'm too old to help you to polish the apple of apartheid. I want to see its abolition, and I want to see good people of all races, including all these marvelous young idealistic teachers who have been flooding these events I'm doing on this book tour everywhere I go. I want to see these people, you know, go beyond the point of fussing and fuming and just making sardonic jokes about President Bush and his terrible syntax, his bad grammar, and get out there and actually act on their beliefs. And that means re-energizing a political struggle that our parents' generation has abandoned. It means getting that their parents' generation has abandoned, and that means taking risks. And you know, there are a lot of like inert liberals who listen to radio stations like this, and they think they're being radical because they've heard of Noam Chomsky, you know, or they think they've somehow changed the world because they went to hear some icon of the left give a lecture somewhere. But that doesn't change the world. That just makes you feel politically good. You've got to go and act on what you believe, or else you've done nothing. I meet people who say the oldest expression you hear among inert liberals is, well, we thought we should, you know, bring some food to a homeless shelter on Thanksgiving, because typically they'll say the very least that you can do is care. They always say the very least you can do is care. And I always, when I hear that, I know what it means. What it really means is the most they'll ever do is care. And care isn't enough. And once a year, charity isn't enough. And charity itself isn't enough. Charity is not a substitute for systematic justice. And there's no systematic justice in the education system for poor kids in this country, especially kids of color.
I've been speaking with Jonathan Kozol, author of The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America.
Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. Today's commentary is about the privatization of American education.
Eight years ago, when Cory Booker made his first bid for mayor of Newark, New Jersey, I exposed him in the pages of the Black Commentator as a product of the Milwaukee-based Bradley Foundation and its network of right-wing think tanks. Back in 2002, Booker was a one-term Newark City Councilman and advocate of publicly funded vouchers for private schools. Millions of dollars in contributions from his many friends on the right allowed Booker to vastly outspend the incumbent mayor, but he still lost. I like to take a little credit for Booker's defeat the first time around, for having warned NORC voters that Booker was a Trojan horse for corporate right-wingers who were determined to privatize the public schools. Booker won his second attempt to capture NORC City Hall in 2006, and former Mayor Sharp James went to prison for corruption. There wasn't too much Mayor Booker could do to privatize NORC schools, since they've been under the control of the state of New Jersey since 1995. Then, last year, Booker got very lucky. New Jersey elected Chris Christie, a fiercely reactionary Republican, as governor. Cory Booker, still the same Trojan horse for the rich right-wingers that had funded his career, had found a political partner in his mission to turn over the public schools to corporations. Booker was already tight with the black right-wing billionaire, Oprah Winfrey. It was on Oprah's show that fellow billionaire Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook owner, announced a $100 million gift to NORC schools to be administered jointly by Booker and the Republican governor. Booker has since gotten commitments for another $40 million from Microsoft's Bill Gates, a New York hedge fund manager, and an educational investment corporation. Cory Booker is rolling in the dough and poised to make his right-wing dreams come true. Just as I warned back in 2002, Booker remains determined to make Newark the national showcase city for corporate education, only now he's got the cash. And he's now part of a full-blown network of capitalists whose mission is to turn American education into a market for power and profit. The billionaires are circling public education like birds of prey, seeking to transform charter schools into an interlocking, national, for-profit business worth trillions of dollars. That's what the hedge funds are after, and that is the mission of Booker Moneybag John Doerr and his California-based New Schools Venture Fund, whose goal is to build an entirely new sector of public education through private investment. They want nothing less than to create a nationwide, corporate-managed schools network paid for by public funds but run by private managers. Cory Booker and Newark are central to this project, as was Washington, D.C., where the viciously anti-union schools chief, Michelle Rhee, will soon be fired after the recent defeat of her Cory Booker-like boss, Mayor Adrian Fenty. The Walmart family and other super-rich right-wingers attempted to take over the D.C. system through millions in contributions with political strings attached. Oprah Winfrey is using her television platform to boost Michelle Rhee for superintendent of Newark schools. Rhee also has the backing of the Obama administration through Education Secretary Arne Duncan. Booker, Fenty, and Obama, corporate Trojan horses, all of them, and deadly enemies of public education. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. For Sonali Subversive Thought for the day, I'd like to quote Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "The secret in education lies in respecting the student." That's a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson. That's Sonali Subversive Thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer and Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can visit us on the web at uprisingradio.org and email us at mail@uprisingradio.org. You can order CDs of Uprising programs at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kohatkar. Thanks for listening. Tiptoe on a stiff rope bound to